Welcome. This is case number 56250, Wayne Davenport versus GMAC Mortgage. Mr. Jackson, Mr. Christian, are you ready to proceed? Very well.
Madam Chief Justice, may it please the court. My name is Mark Jackson. I represent the appellant Wayne Davenport in this matter. At this time, I'd like to reserve 5 minutes for rebuttal. Thank you. In October 2005 specifically, Wayne Davenport entered into an agreement with Stephen Grimm to become a 10% investor in real property. That was in a single piece of real property. Resultingly, over the course of the next year, Mr. Grimm proceeded to purchase 7 properties in Mr. Davenport's name, where he was 100% owner. During this entire time, Mr. Davenport had no idea what was going on. The last property purchased was in October of 2006, and the specific property for which we are here today in this case was the Sierra Paseo property, was purchased in September of 2006, and that was the 5th property purchased. Mr. Davenport was unaware of this during the entire time, and in fact did not become aware of any of these actions until approximately March of 2008, and it wasn't even after it was after March of 2008 when Mr. Davenport was aware that this specific property, the Sierra Paseo property, was even purchased. Resultantly, Mr. Davenport filed a complaint in the district court against numerous defendants, including Stephen Grimm, the mortgage servicing company, the original lender, and the mortgage broker, alleging various causes of action. In response to this complaint, GMAC, the respondent, filed a motion to dismiss, which the district court granted. The main issues behind the district court's granting of the motion to dismiss was, first, the pleading of the complaint on the fraud-based allegations was not particular or specific as required by NRCP 9B. In conjunction with that was plaintiff's request and ultimate denial by the district court of a relaxed pleading standard under this court's 2006 decision, the Rocker versus KPMG.
Counsel, as to that, could you speak as to the special relationship, as to particularity in terms of what GMAC did, since that seems to be part of the issue that the court was troubled with down below?
In going along with that, with what GMAC did, it's not so much what they did, it's what they knew. What plaintiff alleged in his complaint, and it was throughout both the first complaint and the second amended complaint, was GMAC knew that Mr. Grimm was purchasing these properties in Mr. Davenport's name, that the mortgage company was assisting in obtaining the loans, that the lender was obtaining the loans, and that GMAC knew this and proceeded to service the loans afterwards and sell them in the secondary mortgage market.
Salient point. GMAC was not the instigator of these purchases, or in essence, the first bite, so to speak. They were down the road.
Correct. Appellant cited in his various cases in the district court where a subsequent servicer, albeit not the original initiator, not the original lender, can still be liable for that fraud if, one, they either knew that it was going on or assisted, provided substantial assistance.
But that's law in other jurisdictions, is it not?
That is going on in California, correct. And this is a matter of first impression for this court. But along
and if
those,
it's first impression for this court, why should this court adopt that to give you an opportunity to talk about that?
Well, precisely going along with this court's ruling in 1998 in Dow Chemical versus Mailer, going into a duty to disclose. This court held in Dow Chemical that where a party has specific knowledge, and that knowledge is peculiarly within the possession of that party, that creates a duty to disclose.
So you believe that the secondary lender in this case knew that the individuals were purposely defrauding or misusing your client's name, credit information, etc.?
Precisely, and that's based upon this court's ruling in BuzzStew versus City of North Las Vegas, that taking all factual allegations as true, which the district court was required to do, they had to take that as a given. Based upon that, they had a duty to disclose that information because that information was peculiarly within the possession of GMAC. Mr. Davenport never had any idea that this was going on, There's no way he could have obtained that information without the legal discovery process. Therefore, GMAC had that duty to disclose. And it goes to the Henry First Alliance mortgage case and the Placentia case out of California, both out of California, excuse me, where if that knowledge is within the possession of the party, even if they did not initiate the original fraud, and that was the initial fraud was originated by the initial lender, or even a prior mortgage broker, they are still liable for that fraud. In fact, in this court ruling in Young versus Nevada Title in 1987, this court held that a mortgage broker acts as an agent of a mortgage company, and as so, is that mortgage company is responsible and liable for all acts of that mortgage broker. But taking the facts and the factual allegations as true, which the district court was required to do under Bus 2, the fraud and the knowledge of the fraud by GMAC and the initial fraud by the mortgage brokers, by Mr. Grimm, as well as by the initial lender, which was Silver State Mortgage, GMAC would be liable then for all of that fraud, for all of those actions on part of the mortgage broker. Part of the issue that came up was whether there was any misrepresentations that were ever made and whether Mr. Davenport could have relied on those misrepresentations. One of the rulings in Placentia in the Northern District Court of California, in the Federal District Court in the Northern District, said that even if there's no misrepresentations, if there was substantial assistance by this mortgage servicer, the secondary lender, there was substantial assistance in pursuing and perpetrating this fraud, they would still be liable even if no misrepresentations were ever made. Into the reliance part of it, under the California case, and again, this is something of first impression in Nevada, in Morgan versus Wasserman, which is a 1993 case, a California Supreme Court case, that court stated that in order to show reliance, a plaintiff need only show that there was a complete causal relationship between the fraudulent omission and the harm. Or in other words, the plaintiff need only show that had that information been disclosed, he would have acted differently, even if there was actually no misrepresentations made. That's the basis for that reliance. And the Federal District Court in the Northern District of California affirmed that in Romero versus Countrywide. Plaintiff alleged that in this case. He alleged that he did not know of any of this information. He alleged that he had no idea what was going on. It's his belief that GMAC knew of the fraud that was being perpetrated and proceeded along with the entire conspiratorial scheme of Mr. Grimm, Silver State Mortgage, and the mortgage broker.
Counsel, can we get there with Nevada law?
I believe we can. I believe we can, Justice Douglas. And the reason we can get there is based upon this court's ruling in Dow Chemical, in McIntosh versus Jack Matthews, as well as in Young Title, taking all these cases together and the theories that have been and the rulings that have been made in those cases, dealing with a duty to disclose when a party has a particular knowledge and it's within that party's sole possession, where a party is liable and responsible for the acts of their underlying agent, as well as when there is a confidence imposed upon this institution. Granted, if there was no actual contractual relationship between Mr. Davenport and GMAC, there is still a public policy for a confidence imposed upon banking institutions. It's similar to a police. We've never met the police that protect us every day. However, we rely on them and we impose confidences upon them to protect us and protect us from harm. And we assert a confidence that they will not do anything to harm us. This same confidence is requisite in a banking institution, that we impose a confidence upon them that they will not harm us. They will not engage in any activity that will actually endanger us or endanger our financial institutions. The fact of the matter that this specific respondent was sued by the federal government in September of this year for these exact allegations speak to the fact that there was an actual imposition of confidence and that they breached that confidence. So taking the Dow Chemical rulings, the Young versus Nevada Title rulings, the McIntosh rulings that are all Nevada cases, and taking those in conjunction with the California cases and the federal court cases that have already been decided, there actually should be an imposition of a duty owed by a mortgage servicer to a borrower, or an alleged borrower in this case. One last point before I take my break for the rebuttal is under Rocker versus KPMG, where a party has that peculiar knowledge within their own sole possession, and the plaintiff has
Let me stop you there just one second.
Okay.
You keep mentioning that, but didn't the, in response to the opposition, the motion to dismiss, didn't you provide a whole lot of these documents that you're claiming was within the exclusive possession of the defendants?
Correct. Some documents were provided. The documents that were provided were those that we were able to obtain in the pre-litigation stage that were mainly public record. The documents that we needed to prove the actual fraud of what GMAC knew at the time, what they were doing, and what their communications were, that was the documentation that we wanted that we were not able to get absent a legal discovery method.
But that would have been... you provided the loan applications, the notes, the deeds of trust, and those types of documents, didn't you?
We did.
Yeah.
And those documentations, even on their face, show that there was misrepresentations, there was fraud on those faces. For example, on the loan application, it stated that Mr. Davenport was a financial consultant for the past 15 years. In his list of assets, it stated that he had a thrift and savings federal retirement loan. He was actually an employee of the U.S. Postal Service. That was information that he never provided as far as financial consultant. He never provided that to Mr. Grimm or anybody else. That was just put in there. That would have been something that had they looked at the documentation, they should have seen that and had a duty to disclose that information, say, hey, this is not right. You should, is this you? Was this accurate when you made this loan? That's what our position is, that a duty is imposed upon a subsequent servicer to disclose that information when they see that these irregularities, discrepancies, and problems are apparent on the face of the documentation.
Mr. Jackson, did the court consider any documents that weren't attached to the pleading or attached to the Second Amended complaint?
Based upon the order of the district court, I believe no. That's why, rather than converting it to a motion to dismiss, the court kept it within, rather than converting it to a motion for summary judgment, the court kept it within a motion to dismiss. Ergo, going towards the Bustu versus City of North Las Vegas case, where that taking all the factual allegations as true, as was required, and taking all reasonable inferences in favor of the plaintiff, that would have entitled Mr. Davenport to relief. There are no more further questions. I'd like to reserve the rest of my time for rebuttal.
You may do so.
Thank you.
Mr. Christian.
Good morning, and may it please the court. Matthew Christian on behalf of GMAC Mortgage. What I want to do is clarify what this case is not about as I get started here with my argument. This case is not about a home purchaser who happened to buy his home during the height of the market, who's been hit by hard times, who can no longer afford to pay his mortgage, and has been foreclosed upon. Mr. Davenport was an investor. He loaned his name, he loaned his signature, and he loaned his good credit to Eve Mazzarella and Stephen Grimm as part of an elaborate scam to defraud banks.
But he, of course, wasn't involved in the scam.
He was involved to the extent that he knew he was loaning his name. He knew that he was signing his name. He knew that he was being paid for that. He knew that he was not ever going to live in any of these homes that were being purchased in his name. And he knew that he was never going to pay on the note. And in fact, those are the undisputed facts as contained. Those are the undisputed averments that are in the complaint. This was an investment venture. Mr. Davenport has never alleged that he paid one dime on any of these mortgages. That ends up being very important because, as the court has already asked about, this case significantly boils down to whether or not there would be any kind of special relationship between GMAC as a party who had nothing to do with the origination of the loan, and Mr. Davenport, These two parties, the relationship is extremely attenuated. They never had any direct contact. And in order to get around that, what Mr. Davenport needs to do is to convince this court that some kind of special relationship would exist between two parties that have such an attenuated relationship. The question really boils down to whether or not a party like GMAC, in this case, who never had anything to do with the origination, could ever be liable under Nevada law to a homeowner for the bad acts of those who actually did do the origination.
Counsel, it's been argued that we should accept the totality, citing some of our previous decisions. Why shouldn't that fly? Why should we not cite the totality? Or in the going further, why should we not engraft ourselves with the California precedent that was offered?
Judge Kadish looked very closely at these California cases. They're all distinguishable on many levels. In particular, the Ozuna matters that Mr. Davenport has repeatedly relied upon. These cases have to do with the Federal Truth in Lending Act. They have to do with RESPA, and they have to do with other unique qualities of California law. If we look very closely at Nevada law and the cases that Mr. Davenport has repeatedly cited, they are so far removed from the facts of this case that really can't be overlooked. Let's look at McIntosh. I think that's maybe the closest because it's taking place in the context of a home purchase. Completely different scenario. The lender in that case was also the seller. And this court made that distinction very clear in its second opinion, especially in its second opinion. That lender, again, who was the seller, knew that there was a major problem with flooding in the basement. It chose not to reveal that to the borrower and to the purchaser. And that fact enticed, the silence would have enticed the purchaser into purchasing the property. And what this court says was that a purchaser in that situation should have been able to rely upon the seller to have disclosed any major defects in the property, because why would a bank loan money using the house as collateral if there were any major defects? So McIntosh significantly turns on whether or not there could ever be reliance. Did the purchaser rely on the silence, rely on the implied representation that there was nothing wrong with the home in order to change his position? That is a very significant difference in this case, and that is something that the complaint on its face never addresses in any way, shape, or form. How did Mr. Davenport rely on GMAC's silence when Mr. Davenport had already loaned his name, had already signed the documents, and the loans had already gone through, the purchases had already been made? What good would it have been to Mr. Davenport for GMAC to have delved into the original loan documents, looked at them thoroughly enough to somehow discover that there was an elaborate scam going on that injured all the lenders and all the servicers, and then somehow revealed that to Mr. Davenport at that point in time? Mr. Davenport had already, the train had already left the station for Mr. Davenport. He had already loaned his name, and there would be no reliance.
Mr. Christian, it's possible that there's no reliance, at least with respect to anything GMAC said or did, but there is one cause of action in the complaint, at least with respect to a motion to dismiss standard of review, that I'd like you to comment about, and that's civil conspiracy. Under our elements for civil conspiracy, why wouldn't the complaint, at least that claim for relief, survive a dismissal and allow discovery as to that question?
Well, a couple of main points, I think, Justice Hardesty. The complaint, the allegations that are contained in the complaint are very sparse on whether or not such an agreement would have ever existed and could have ever existed.
What's alleged that it existed?
The complaint alleges a lot of things, and it alleges that an elaborate agreement existed between the originators and subsequent lenders and subsequent servicers. And if I can just clarify one thing for the court, the record does not identify what GMAC's role actually was. The complaint lists GMAC as an original lender. It lists us as a servicer. It lists us as a broker, a mortgage broker, and it lists us as a purchaser. The record, we never got to the point of ever even identifying what GMAC actually did here. Mr. Davenport acknowledges that we were not part of the origination, but rather only came in after the fact. But the details have always been missing.
Do you agree with your colleague that the court did not consider anything other than what was attached to the second amended complaint in deciding this motion to dismiss?
I was looking at that very closely, Justice Hardesty, yesterday, because both Mr. Davenport and I repeatedly quoted Mr. Davenport's affidavit.
Right.
And it is part of the appendix, and it's not file stamped, and it's dated around the time of my original motion to dismiss.
Well, that's what it looked like to me, so I wondered why this wasn't a summary judgment review.
There's a parallel matter that's before the court that I handled on behalf of GMAC's subsidiary, Homecomings Financial. In that matter, Judge Johnson converted the exact same motion to dismiss into a motion for summary judgment, and Her Honor granted the motion as a motion for summary judgment. And to a certain extent, possibly we're getting into whether or not the court should adopt a new standard for motions to dismiss. I know that I suggested that such a possibility has arisen by the facts of this case. I did that in my respondent's brief.
Well, this is why I posed the question about civil conspiracy. Under our existing standard, why wouldn't this complaint as to that cause of action satisfy a motion to dismiss or survive a motion to dismiss? And to the extent that the court would consider Trombley or Iqbal, would that standard nevertheless defeat a claim for civil conspiracy in this case?
I don't think so. And in terms of the standard that the court presently uses to determine a motion to dismiss, I don't think it ultimately matters, and here's why. It gets back to reliance and damage. Civil conspiracy is still going to require Mr. Davenport to plead and to prove that the conspiracy somehow caused either reliance or causation, I guess.
But under Rocker, he's saying, look, I don't know exactly the extent of the involvement of GMAC in the civil conspiracy, and I'm contending that there's some documents in their possession that would demonstrate that they know of the problems that existed with the origination of this loan.
Under the present standard, there is still a causation element that Mr. Davenport would have been required to plead and to prove. And in this case, he didn't really plead it. He pled causation, generally speaking. Every one of the causes of action contains an averment that there was either causation or, in the case of fraud, that there was reasonable reliance. But the remainder of the complaint doesn't contain any other facts that even make it possible that Mr. Davenport would have relied upon any underlying fraud that would be required in a conspiracy claim. There still must be some underlying bad act or a fraud that was taking place below that would have caused the damages that Mr. Davenport alleges. And other than the bare legal conclusion that Mr. Davenport asserts in his complaint, there are no other facts. And why would that be? Well, because there couldn't be any other averments on that. The loan had already been taken out. The signature had already been lent. The credit had already been lent. By the time any of the other necessary elements of the cause of action would have arisen, before damages would have arisen.
But I understand the civil conspiracy claim to say that GMAC is aware of the activities or agreed to the activities engaged in by the mortgage broker and the originating lender. Whether or not they came along later is the issue in the civil conspiracy allegation, isn't it? I mean, causation certainly would exist as to the originating lender and the mortgage broker. So if they're a member of the civil conspiracy, why wouldn't that claim survive a motion to dismiss?
Well, I think it does come back to reliance or causation in that case, because the conspiracy isn't what caused any alleged damage. And the other point, too, Justice, is the damage element that immediately follows any allegation of reliance or causation. There is a bare-boned legal conclusion that Mr. Davenport has been damaged by all of this in the amount of $10,000 or greater, but there are no other averments in the complaint demonstrating how it could ever be that he was damaged. The complaint admits this was an investment venture. There's no assertion whatsoever that Mr. Davenport ever paid any money on any of these notes. So how is it that he ever could have been damaged?
Did he claim that his credit was injured?
He did claim that
as a result of a foreclosure?
He did claim that his credit was injured, but whether or not that would have ever caused monetary damage is not something that he ever pled.
But for purposes of a motion to dismiss, he averred that his credit was damaged, right?
Right. He did. I did raise the issue of Twombly and whether or not that would change the analysis and possibly...
And how would it change the analysis on that cause of action?
I think on that cause of action, it would change the analysis, and at least...
How would it? Presented. Why don't you offer that?
Well, in terms of whether there are a couple points that I'd like to make in terms of Twombly. Twombly clarifies a couple of things in the federal courts. One is that the court need not take bare-boned legal conclusions in the complaint as true. And in terms of reliance and causation, I think that fits squarely into this case. Is it reasonable to, is it plausible to think that Mr. Davenport relied on or that his damages, if any, were caused by any of these underlying acts? I see that my time is running
out. Please complete your thought and respond to Justice Hardesty's question.
Thank you, Justice Seda. In terms of that clarification of the law, Twombly actually isn't doing anything revolutionary or drastic. The law had been, in federal court at least, that a district court was always entitled to ignore bare conclusions of law. Applied to this case...
But that's true under Nevada law as well.
Exactly.
Conclusory allegations of law are, you know...
So in terms of accepting Twombly or clarifying Nevada's Rule 12 standard of review, I don't think that really is revolutionary in any way. This court or the district court could have disregarded bare legal conclusions in the complaint with regard to causation and reliance.
Well, what are the bare legal allegations that you think should have been disregarded with respect to the conspiracy claim?
Reliance and causation. Like, I think they can be disregarded for every one of the causes of action. Again, these events took place when Mr. Davenport signed his name, when he lent his name, and when he lent his credit discovering that or somehow preventing that by another party that was not part of the origination process would not have changed any of that. He still would have done that. The market still would have collapsed, and he still would have been left with seven homes in his name. So placing the responsibility onto GMAC for that, there's a missing link, whether it be through causation or reliance. There's a missing link between those events. Let me just finish up, if I may.
Counsel, before you make that statement, though, going back to Iqbal, it talks in terms of plausible claims for relief and reasonable inferences. Don't we get that in the conspiracy clause?
I think with Twombly, my next point was going to be about plausibility versus impossibility. Certainly, if the standard were lowered from impossibility to implausibility, then it would be easier to obtain dismissal. And to the extent that that would be a change in Nevada law, then of course it would be. Before Iqbal, of course, there was Twombly. Twombly actually is pretty close to the circumstances here. That case was about whether there was a conspiracy, whether there was an underlying agreement between telecommunication companies, the baby bells, to violate the Sherman Act, the Antitrust Act.
I think we're familiar with the case. I'm going to need you to wrap up a little bit.
Sorry about that, Justice. In that case, the court decided that it was implausible to believe that the baby bells were conspiring because it couldn't have been in their interest to do that. The same exact thing is true here. Why would GMAC conspire in such a manner just so that it could purchase a loan that didn't have any backing to it? It was fraudulent from its conception. It wouldn't have done GMAC any good to have been a co-conspirator. It was a victim. It purchased the loan and it was victimized by this. So with that, thank you.
Thank you, Mr. Christian. Mr. Jackson.
I'm going to add 1 minute to Mr. Jackson's time since we allowed Mr. Christian to proceed a bit longer.
Thank you. Addressing the plausibility argument and this standard, what respondent is asking this court to do is to disregard approximately 54 years of precedent. In 1957, in Taylor versus State, this court established that the standard for pleading is no set of facts standard. Notice pleading under NRCP Rule 8A1. This has been reaffirmed time and time again. Most recently, in the case of this year, of May of this year, of In Re Americo derivative litigation, wherein the court additionally held that even inferences of wrongdoing are sufficient to give notice. In fact, in the comments regarding picking factual conclusions and legal conclusions and being able to disregard those, this court held not only in Taylor versus State, but also in Crusoe versus Carson City in 1979 that even the district court can take factual conclusions and legal conclusions as sufficient to plead a cause of action as long as they are sufficient to give notice of what the nature and grounds of the cause of action are.
So what is your conspiracy claim in maybe 20 words or less?
Our conspiracy claim was Mr. Grimm, the mortgage broker, the original lender, and GMAC and the subsequent servicers either knew at the time of the origination of the loan or subsequently knew that they were purchasing this home by false pretenses without Mr. Davenport's knowledge for the purpose of selling it on the secondary mortgage market to make money. That's what was going on. GMAC didn't get stuck with a bag at the end of the day. The taxpayers got stuck with a bag at the end of the day based on the TARP bailouts. GMAC sold the loan on the secondary mortgage market for a profit. They made money. That is why the federal government has sued GMAC along with 20 or so other institutions, financial institutions, subsequent mortgage lenders, for $200 billion for this exact conduct. That's the conspiracy.
And how was that directed to your client?
That is directed towards my client because they were using his name. He got stuck with this note and this loan in his name that he never knew about. He was never aware of this Sierra Paseo property. He was going to be a 10% investor in one property. This was the fifth property purchased in his name. He was never aware of that. Now he has this foreclosure in his name and on his credit, and not only has it caused him financial difficulty and harm by his credit, as Justice Harvey was pointing out, but also emotional distress, pain and suffering, which was alleged and pled in the complaint.
So the damages are the foreclosure on your trustee's sale on your record. Is there any other damages other than that? And you say the emotional distress that you're alleging your client sustained?
Correct. The emotional distress, the financial part of it with the foreclosure, and the emotional distress and the conscious pain and suffering that he has experienced going through repeated people telling him he has these foreclosures on his name, and in this economic situation and this in these economic times, the pressure that puts on somebody and the difficulties that poses with someone that only makes $46,000 a year as a postal worker.
But there's no deficiency action. There's no other type of financial claim against him. That's all. The statute of limitations is passed on that.
As far as the statute of limitations passing on a deficiency action, I'm not entirely sure if the 6 years of statute of limitations for a breach of contract action would have passed already.
This was a first, though, wasn't it?
There was a first and a second.
What was GMAC? Was it this first or the second?
I believe it was. I don't recall, actually.
Okay. If it's the first, it's 6 months.
If the first, it was 6 months to bring a deficiency action, but right. There's still the contract. They still have a breach of contract action they can bring for the six-year statute of limitations.
You might want to read a case called Walters that Justice Douglas just wrote. It might answer that question.
Okay. And that's
maybe true. The question I have, though, is how do you tie the victimization of your client by Mr. Grimm to GMAC in the complaint?
It is tied through...
There isn't any showing that GMAC knew that this was a sham. To their perspective, your client was appropriately on the documents, correct?
With all the respect, I would disagree. There okay. was a showing that GMAC did in fact know. And specifically, looking at paragraphs in the Second Amended Complaint, 33, 35, 36, 41, 42, 46, 47, 48, 57, 58, 59, 84, 96, 97, 100, and 101, they all allege that GMAC, in fact, did know that this was going on, that these loans had been put in his name fraudulently for the purpose of obtaining money and making money without his knowledge or consent. So well, in fact, there was allegations that GMAC did, in fact, know.
Mr. Jackson, allegation 150 and 151 also articulate the existence of a civil conspiracy. But what say you to the argument by Mr. Christian here that if the court were to adopt Iqbal in particular, it would still dismiss this complaint because it's simply not plausible?
The plausibility argument really comes down to what do you believe. If you believe that GMAC knew, and taking under Buzz Stu versus North City of Las Vegas, that they have to take these allegations as true, that GMAC actually knew that this was going on, that they knew that the mortgages were taken out in his name for Oxfam, and that they proceeded to make money on this action by selling it on the secondary mortgage market. If that's true, if you believe that, that's definitely plausible. And the plausibility of it is, could this happen? Yes, it could. Is it nonsensical? No, and it's not nonsensical in the sense of, would it be nonsensical to say any institution is not going to engage in any type of wrongdoing? That would be a nonsensical argument. The plausibility of it is, yes, in fact, the mortgage servicers knew of what was going on, as alleged, and there was damage resulting from it. But it really gets into going into the plausibility argument, really starts taking away from the 54 years of precedent and this court's standard and public policy of trying each case on their merits and putting it into a balancing scheme and an evidence weighing situation right at the very outset. And taking it from a possible no set of facts standard and putting it towards a weighing the balance scales of what is more probable than not, and basically requiring a plaintiff to prove in the very initial pleading stages that his case wins, rather than at trial and having that done by the trier of fact. And in fact, that even goes into contravention and raises serious constitutional concerns with the Nevada Constitution under Article 1, Section 3.
Jackson, I'm going to have to ask you to complete your thought if Justice Hardesty's question has been answered.
Yes, it has.
In completion, it raises constitutional concerns in Article 1, Section 3, where it says that the right to a jury trial is inviolate. By adopting this new standard, this new pleading standard, which many other jurisdictions have rejected completely, and which there is no showing of any predicate policy concerns, which was the basis for the Twombly and Iqbal adopting the standard. Absent these, there's no reason to just wipe out with a stroke of a pen 54 years of precedent.
Thank you. Not necessary. Thank you, Mr. Jackson.
Thank you.
All rise.